The roof extended out and down from the sides of the house to a distance of perhaps 10 feet, giving about 7 feet clearance between the ground and the edges of the eaves. There were windows in the places where one would expect windows to be, but these had no panels, screens, or glass, just frames through which the trade winds wafted the delightful fragrance of tropical flowers. There were lots of mosquitoes, of course, but over our three beds there was a huge net that kept out the buzzing pests. Each evening servants would come in and lower the nets for us, then with fan-like brushes would drive out all the mosquitoes that had collected in the room. The meals were prepared in two huts in the yard, one for cooking and the other for baking. Our gracious hostess had her kitchens going like beehives a few minutes after our arrival. The commissioner's wife had just enough coffee left in her supply to make us one pot, which she gave us immediately. When I tasted my first sip of coffee, I was able to believe at last that it was all true and not one of those nightmares I used to have when I dozed in the raft. We were really safe. It seemed impossible to believe, but that welcome cup of coffee was the convincer. Lying there in civilized beds, we realized for the first time what an ordeal we had come through, as evidenced by the physical conditions and reactions which now pressed themselves upon our consciousness. Our skinned backs and cooked hips kept us in constant torment for many days, and we found ourselves still unable to sleep at first. Now that we were relieved of the spiritual compulsion, the overpowering drive from inward that makes a man fight for his life against any odds, the ills and ravages of the body asserted themselves at once with a violence that stripped our nerves and left us helpless. We were dizzy for several days, and when we dropped asleep briefly, we had nightmares that surpassed in horror even those we had experienced in the raft. Our legs had been so long doubled up in the raft, with little room to stand and none to walk, that as we abandoned our tired bodies to complete relaxation now, they froze into the sitting position. We were able to straighten them after a week, but until then I lay most of the time on my back with my knees in the air, as I had seen my friend lie in sickbay aboard the ship the day I had the presentiment that I would sometime be in the same position. That strange warning from somewhere, it had come true on this island. I knew, though, that we were not to die. As for the boys, I had to warn them not to overdo the eating. We were going to be all right. The commissioner was gone a great deal that day. We soon learned that he was very much concerned over the fact that the barometer was dropping rapidly while the wind seemed to be increasing. The tall, slim palms were threshing back and forth like whips. The roar almost drowned the excited voices of the natives, who were running about securing their possessions, for it was plain that this was to be a disastrous storm. By evening, the gale had built to a hurricane. The surf was crashing like a series of small tidal waves against the tiny coral island. The thunderous boom of the sea and the wind howling through thousands of palm trees combined in an overpowering din that dominated all else and seemed to make the whole island shake. Then the rain was hurled against our house like tremendous buckets of marbles. The commissioner's house was substantial and stood the ruthless beating without injury, but the natives' little homes were lifted from the ground and tumbled about like toys. Many of them ended as mere heaps of sticks and straw tangled among hundreds of fallen coconut palms. There were about 700 natives on the island, and from what I observed now and later, I believe every man, woman, and child of them was badly frightened that night. The commissioner instructed the native chief to move his people from the low part of the island, where the principal village was located, to the higher ground around the government house. They came, bringing as much of their possessions as they could carry in the storm. The commissioner's residence stood in a big grove of coconut palms, and we were worried that one of them might fall upon the house and cave it in. There were hundreds of natives taking refuge in the grove, and why none was struck by a falling tree I'll never understand. Outside of superficial cuts and bruises, suffered as the wind flung them about, they all came out of it unhurt, although many lost all their possessions and some became ill from exposure. The trees fell like jackstraws. Many of those that did not blow over were stripped of their fronds, leaving them grotesquely high waving stumps. All the nuts that were in the trees dropped, of course, whether they were ripe or not. In the rain, all the commissioner's fuel supply for cooking was soon wetted. As a result, our distressed hostess was unable to give us a great deal to eat except coconuts during the hurricane. She did manage to keep tea brewed, and once we ate dumplings, which she steamed in her oven as the only available substitute for bread. The next morning she managed to get us 2 eggs each. Those were the last. The hurricane stopped the hens from laying. The second morning she made a pudding of arrowroot, one of the island staples. Of course, we had lots of taro, which these islanders cook like potatoes. They do not make poi from taro as the Hawaiians do. She fixed coconut in various appetizing ways, but hungry as I was, I found her coconut cream too rich for my taste and could drink little of it. I did consume enormous quantities of the coconut milk. Taro appeared to be the island's staff of life. The commissioner had his own taro beds on high ground, but they were small and were expected to supply only the needs of the household. The natives did their cultivating on the lower lands, where they might be washed out if the wind rose high enough to blow the sea over the island. This is exactly what happened. On the second day of the storm, the great waves rushed inland, completely destroying all the taro. This disaster alone would have left the islanders in a serious plight. The hurricane lasted 3 days, and the damage that it did in that time was enormous. On the fourth morning, when the tumult of wind and rain had left the battered and bedraggled little island behind, the commissioner made a tour of inspection and came back with a grave face. He estimated that a third of the coconut trees on the island had been blown down. Those left standing were so badly punished that it would be 2 years, he estimated, before they would be in condition to bear again. All the island's taro was killed except his own home garden, and all the banana trees were destroyed beyond repair. The commissioner explained, very worried, that the island was low on provisions of all sorts because there had not been a supply ship along in some time owing to the war. There was a little rice, flour, tea, sugar, and salt, but the stock of canned goods was almost gone. His wife had used the last tins of carrots and peas to make a stew for us our first day on the island. Chickens were still plentiful, and there were wild pigs, but of general provisions, the islanders now had a supply sufficient for only 2 weeks. Nevertheless, the natives, a brave and generous people, began pouring gifts of food upon us as soon as the hurricane had subsided. They remained carefree and confident, even in the face of the impending famine. The native who had found us was typical. With his home gone, his gardens ruined, and no boat coming until no one knew when, he sat down and wove for me a beautiful coconut hat with a band of beaded shells. He gathered somewhere a basket of coconuts, another basket of taro, and 2 chickens, one live and one cooked, and presented them to us. When the other natives heard of this, they all dropped their cares and began streaming up to the commissioner's house with all sorts of gifts. Among them were several intricate shellwork hat bands and other trinkets, coconut mats, and other articles of native handicraft at which they are unequaled. The commissioner, not to be outdone, made each of us a present of genuine South Sea pearls. Many of the natives brought gifts of food, usually a chicken, either alive or cooked, and in some cases both. These chickens look like Plymouth Rocks, except that their legs are considerably longer. They are apparently good layers, and their meat leaves no complaint. One native brought us a quarter of a pig freshly killed. This pork tasted different from any I had ever eaten before. It tasted more like chicken. The fat didn't contain much grease, and the lean meat was very tender. I learned that the island swine, after weaning, are allowed to run loose in the jungle, where I presume they live mostly on coconuts. The newborn pigs are allowed to suckle the sow only 7 days. Then they are taken away and are fed the same preparation of coconut milk that the native mothers give their babies. This is not the clear liquid from the inside of the mature coconut, which is what we call the milk. The islanders prefer the liquid obtained by taking a spoon and working on the juicy meat of the coconut kernel I have already described. These natives are curious, friendly, and entirely unspoiled by contact with the ways of civilization. They have no firearms, but have big knives, which the men handle with extreme skill. The men all smoke cigarettes, which they make by cutting up plug tobacco and rolling it into a slip of dried pandanus leaf. We were hungry for a smoke, of course, and soon learned the art. Smoking is their only civilized vice. They have no liquors. After the first 3 days, when we were able to sit on the veranda for our meals, the islanders gathered in great swarms to watch us eat. When they could get near us, they would stand about for hours looking at us without a word. This was embarrassing to us at first, but we soon got used to them and paid no attention. One woman I remember particularly. She watched us for 3 days without a let-up, just leaning on her elbows and gazing. Under the kind and skillful care of the commissioner's wife, we recuperated amazingly. Strength began to flow back into our muscles, and in a few days we were able to straighten our legs, then to walk with only a barely perceptible unsteadiness. We were still weak, of course, and were to remain so for some time, but mentally we seemed quite normal, all of us, and that relieved a worry I had had. I could feel the weight growing back on my bones, and I could see Jean and Tony putting on pounds by the day. In fact, the most serious difficulty any of us had then was to keep from gorging on the food that the natives were continually putting before us. When it no longer tired me too much to talk, I had long conversations with the commissioner about the island and the serious food shortage he and his people faced because of the hurricane. With war conditions as they were in the Southwest Pacific, he didn't know when he could expect relief. I was becoming a bit anxious, too, about getting back home to the Pacific Fleet where I belonged. The commissioner then said that he had radioed an urgent plea for help but had no answering word that he could take as assurance of immediate help. Radioed? What? I had been almost a week on the island and didn't know there was a radio. I went into action without delay. It seemed that the government had installed a small radio transmitter on the island and had sent a trained native of one of the larger islands in that area to man it for the duration of the war. Straight away, I met this operator. He had some real cigarette tobacco, and we discussed matters over my first honest-to-goodness civilized smoke. The languid South Sea air got a message to carry in a hurry. I made my report to my commanding officer and went back to rest and recuperate, confident that we'd get some action now. We did. 7 days from the date of our arrival on the island, there was an American warship offshore, and pretty soon we were shaking hands with the commander. The ship that rescued us also saved the island.